This recording is a production of Faith Builders Educational Programs. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2016, held at Faith Builders on August 1 through 5.
Good morning. Thank you, Lyle. I appreciated that. I wonder how many of us here are here because of some teacher. And all we are is a conduit, a channel, a conduit. While he was talking and making that illustration, I looked over there at that conduit, and I wonder how many of you looked over there this week and thought, how beautiful that conduit is. That is so beautiful and amazing. It's the first thing I notice when I come in here is that conduit. No, you didn't even think about it, did you? But it's doing a very important work. Okay, David the King. We are finally here at the last session, and now we're finally going to talk about what David is known for, being king. Now, yesterday he was a fugitive. We left him in a cave with some unruly men. And I don't want us to forget that David was being useful there and doing God's will there. It wasn't that David's usefulness began when he became king. And you've heard quotes similar to this. I couldn't find this exact quote, so this is kind of my own rendering of it. But the greatest work that you will ever do for God is the work he has called you to do right now. We are way too enamored with thinking about what God might be preparing me for. That great moment somewhere in the future when I'm finally going to be somebody. And all through his life, whether he was a shepherd, whether he was a harpster in the king's court, or fighting a giant, or living in a cave, or running from a tyrant king, he was doing God's will. And that was the greatest work for him in that moment. So let's not forget that. Now David is 30 years old, and his leadership skills are going to be put on display, and he is going to be king. And he will not do it perfectly. We've exalted David pretty high this week, but now his weaknesses start to emerge. I have 6 children, and occasionally when I look at them, and I wonder about the future and where they will go, and will they serve God? Will they be able to survive in the crumbling world we live in? And I just wonder, am I doing this all right? David doesn't provide much inspiration for me when it comes to parenting. He just didn't always get it right. I would refuse ever being king in order to have a healthy family environment. I wouldn't trade places with David at all. His family was a mess. But nevertheless, he was king. And he would be a different king than King Saul. And God had given him tests to prove it to the entire nation of Israel. This man will not be like King Saul. This man passed an ultimate test and walked away from power. He is not an ambitious man. So we will spend some time today looking at various little snapshots of David, some of the responses to the test David faced as king. And again, this is not an exhaustive overview of leadership qualities. Neither is it even, I'm not even looking at this as the most important things about leadership. Just various observations of the qualities of David as a leader. Maybe these qualities were typical of David, but they may not necessarily be typical qualities that you'll find in most leaders today. But you found them in David. And I think they will serve us well in our school if we try to apply these to our life as well. The first thing that I would like to look at is in 1 Chronicles 22, verse 8. David had a dream. David had a good dream. You know, some of you all like to imagine things. What could I do? What could I do for our school? And you hear a lot about how we need to, you know, dream about good things for our school, plans for our school. Where are we headed in the next 20 years? What are some things we want to establish, to cultivate? And David had a dream like that. He wanted to build a temple for his God. I can't think of a better dream to have. And David had the incredibly disappointing experience of having God shut it down. At least for him. And it's not the right thing to talk about when you're talking about implementing vision. You know, it's basically how are we going to make this happen? But here I'm kind of suggesting that sometimes God comes in and kind of musses with our visionary plans and maybe redirects them or changes them or stalls them back. It just doesn't always work out the way we think it should or as fast as we think it should. And so here is David, and you know, this was such a good vision that when the prophet came, he said, "Oh, David, that's excellent. Sure, go. Do it." Not even the prophet comprehended what God had in mind. But that night, God informed the prophet that, look, this is not what I have for David. And you go back and you tell him. And David, true to form, gave in, went to the house of the Lord, and worshiped. Very typical of David. Now, let's make some observations here about David. David's vision is greater than his place of service. Now, he was the military man. He was the man that was going to make the nation of Israel great. Geographically, militaristically, that was his place of service, his God-ordained place of service. He conquered the Philistines. They would never more be a threat. He had shed a lot of blood. And so this vision, although it was good, was outside of God's plan for him. God just did not have this in mind for David. God never said it wasn't a good vision. It would eventually come to fruition. And David would plan for it, prepare for it, but he would not get the credit for building this temple. So we'll just read this verse. "But the word of the Lord came to me, saying, Thou hast shed blood abundantly, and hast made great wars. Thou shalt not build an house unto my name. Behold, a son shall be born to thee. He shall build an house for my name." Now, it is interesting that God didn't just slam him down and say, no. But David, this will come, but you're not the man. And David accepted that. And this is hard. I have struggled with this. David's vision was greater than his place of service. And actually, that is a good thing. It is good to have dreams and plans for the kingdom of God and to be excited. If you want to know what my burning passion is, my number one burning passion, it is not school. It is the Church of Jesus Christ on this earth. That is my number one passion. And school is somewhere underneath of that. And God has given me a place to work in that kingdom. I am incredibly honored. Over here is a place. It is school. Sometimes my vision burns so much that I start thinking about other areas and other things that could be done. And you almost feel like you're locked away. in a little box, kind of like the army that goes in to conquer a country. And as they're sweeping through the land, the boys on the front lines are all having fun. They're on the front line of the work. And things are happening. This is a great work, and we're taking down the enemy and conquering. And one day the commander comes and bursts a few of them's bubble and makes them be guards in the land that's already conquered. Now, what fun is that, to just be a guard? I mean, here stands the guard. And his vision is much broader than just being a guard. I mean, I was made for big stuff, you know, like Scuffy the tugboat. That teaches an important lesson, by the way. I was meant for bigger things. And his vision is much larger than just being guard. But that makes him a good guard, right? If he really cares about the advancing army, he's going to stay right where he is and be the best guard he can be. And if he lets his ambition get the better of him, and he's, I was made for the front lines, and forsakes his post and goes to the front lines, he may do the most heroic work up there. He may win medals up there. But when the commander comes, he's going to say, "Bad boy, because why is the enemy advancing from behind? You forsook your post." And so I think it is good if our vision is larger than our place of service. But don't forget to faithfully stay right where you are. What do I have next here? David was willing to let others have the honor of carrying out his vision. Carrying out vision is important, but others need to help us sometimes. And maybe just a few more thoughts about implementing vision. We have big dreams for our schools, big dreams for our classrooms. I taught with a young man a couple years ago. He came to our school. Before he'd taught a day, we had already started entering into big discussions about music. He loved music. I loved music. And he was frustrated with the music choices in his community. "They are pathetic," he said. And he had good music choices, he thought. And he wished he could change his community. And we batted ideas around. And finally I said, "You know, I think I know what you need to do. You need to become the community's school teacher and stay there for 20 years. Because you do not change music tastes in 1 year or 2 years or 5 years." And I have found in implementing vision that you cannot do anything fast. Slow, small changes are the most accepted and the most permanent. Slow, small changes are the most accepted by the community and the most permanent. Do anything fast, you'll probably have people pushing back. And before long, you'll watch your vision fall flat. And when you commit to slow, small change, you're probably committing to something that you will probably never reap the fruit of. Or it's possible. David didn't. David died. There was no temple in Israel. But there would be a temple. Solomon would get the credit for that. And implementing vision is not an effective process, is not an efficient process. You know, we talk about efficiency versus effectiveness. And I've found that, you know, if efficiency is up, there's an inverse relationship between them. If I'm being very efficient, I'm probably being very ineffective. Have you ever found that to be true? Now, I'm not sure the opposite is true, because if when you're being really efficient, you're being ineffective, does it really work the other way? If you're really inefficient, you're really effective? No, I'm not going to give you that benefit. If you're inefficient, you're probably ineffective as well. And the reason is because efficiency is easy to measure. effectiveness is very difficult to measure. And these have been some of the frustrations for me in implementing vision. But to be content with a slow, cumbersome way forward sometimes, not always feeling efficient, but maybe sometimes I have to stand back and say, but this, Lord, maybe this is the effective way to go about it. And I have to be okay with someone else getting the glory. This is the life of a pioneer, you know. The pioneer lives a rough life, carving out a new life in a new land. And if the pioneers that landed on Plymouth Rock could somehow be resurrected and they could see that today, wouldn't they just drop over to see a city like that there? But they never knew anything of that. They never knew anything of the America we know. Of course, that's an earthly example. But we need to be fine with someone else reaping the fruit. And David committed himself to that, did not bulldoze away his way out of God's plan for him. All right, another observation from David. David was a man after God's own heart, but David sinned. There's a story in the Perspectives of Life literature book about King Saul. You remember that one? Those of you that teach that book, you're familiar with that book on King Saul. The author there makes this observation that it's possible to go through the Old Testament and list more sins that David committed than that King Saul committed. That might be debatable. But for some reason, in the midst of David's sin, he still won God's favor. Saul, in the midst of his sin, never did. And I'd like to look at that difference just a little bit. And we'll take a verse from Psalm 51, a very well-known psalm, one you've read when you've sinned, probably. We just picked out verse 4. The entire passage is good to meditate on, but we'll just look at verse 4. Brings out a principle that David lived his life by, and a very important principle for anyone that's going to be in authority. Against thee only have I sinned and done this evil in thy sight, that thou mightest be justified when thou speakest, and be clear when thou judgest. Saul was different than David when he sinned. When Saul sinned, he justified himself. Did you ever justify yourself? I have taught with 20 plus teachers over the years. And here's the scenario. It's a young 20-some-year-old teacher. And it's PT meeting. And my little thing at parent-teacher meeting is, they come to me, oh, they're all nervous about parent-teacher meeting. Like, well, it's a very simple little procedure. The first thing you do when they come in is you say, hello, how are you, of course. And then you say, what are you hearing from home? And you let them tell you. And then you say, what are your concerns? And you let them tell you. And then you tell them what's going right at school. And then ask them maybe if they would like to know about the one or two things that is not going so well. And they follow that procedure, but I have watched some of them. When they ask those first two questions, what are you hearing from home and how do you feel about how things are going? The parents start giving feedback and they cannot resist the urge to justify themselves. And 40-year-old parents will not take justifying yourself from a 20-year-old. They just don't take it. And so, oh, if I could just convince you to resist the urge to justify yourself. But I've felt that. I have failed at it. When they start coming, you just would just like to help them see your the way you did it. I think the best thing to say in the crunch moment there when they're telling you those things, well, that's interesting. I hadn't thought about that. Just as a way to be able to back away and give it some time to think and process it. Please try to resist the immediate urge to come up with justification, even if they are being unreasonable Saul blamed others. And you know what's interesting about Saul is that he, more than anyone else in the Bible, at least as recorded, Saul said, "I have sinned." Saul said, "I have sinned," more than anyone else in the Bible. If you want to make an interesting morning chapel some morning, study all the people in the Bible that said, "I have sinned." You can make some interesting observations. Go to your Power Bible and enter, "I have sinned," and all the verses will come up, right? Maybe you've done something like that already. Saul said it more than anyone else. And yet, he was only confessing for political advantage, for Samuel's favor. When David sinned, it was because he realized he had sinned against God. And verse 4 is especially interesting because of that last phrase, "that thou mightest be justified when thou speakest and be clear when thou judgest." This is interesting that a monarch would see this, because most monarchs are the law of the land, right? The king answers to nobody. He can twist and shape the law however he wants because he is sovereign. David refuses to do that. David says, "I answer to God." And he understands that there in Israel, Israel works differently than the surrounding nations. In Israel, the king is not the law of the land. It's God's law we are governed by. It was a constitution, similar to the way the United States works. And the constitution is the law of our land, supposed to be. We're not going to get into all the politics of that. But David put himself under that. The law of this land is God's law. I am somewhere second. And in no way, shape, or form did David want to make God's law inconsistent or bring shame to God's law. And so he said, "God, your law says this, I accept it." Now that was a mouthful for David, because by the law of God, David should have died. And this is interesting. David put himself before the Lord and said, your judgment I will accept, that you may be clear when you speak and clear when you judge. Interesting story, interesting account there that God was merciful to him and put away his sin. But the key difference between Saul and David: Saul justified himself, blamed others, confessed only for political advantage. David, like a real leader, was not afraid to get up and say, "I'm sorry." I've taught 12 years, but this very last year, I still had to get up in front of my boys, my 16 boys. I had shamed one of them publicly. I didn't mean to. I was meaning to make a point, but it came across too shameful. And I got convicted about it and thought, you know, there's only one thing to do, and that's to get right up in front of all of them and say, "I'm sorry." And that just clears the air, and you can go on. And so a good leader knows how to say, "I'm sorry," before God and these witnesses. Okay. Now we're going to look at something that is similar to yesterday. David faces the power test again. Except this time it's not from Saul. It is from his son, Absalom. Absalom is not like his father at all. And Absalom is power hungry. And Absalom wishes for a following. He is insecure unless he has a following. And so he steals the hearts of the children of Israel through smooth talking and gains a following. How could those well-meaning Israelites ever follow Absalom? Well, David wasn't perfect, we said, and they probably saw things, and Absalom could make a good case for it, you know. "Oh, that I were made judge in the land." In other words, Dad doesn't have... I'm awfully sorry about this, folks, but Dad just doesn't... He just doesn't have this figured out right. You can almost imagine Absalom being smooth in that way. And by smooth speech, he stole the hearts of Israel and began an insurrection against his own dad. It seems like God is standing back again and saying, okay, let's put David on display again. Here comes his own son that he was not able to train correctly for whatever reasons. God never seems to hold that over his head. But here's the test. What will David do now? Now David is the anointed king, the anointed of the Lord. He is king. What will David do? 2 Samuel 15, verse 14. And David said unto all his servants that were with him at Jerusalem, arise and let us flee. For we shall not else escape from Absalom. Make speed to depart, lest he overtake us suddenly and bring evil upon us and smite the city with the edge of the sword. Now, there is no time to wait on God for an answer. Did you ever find yourself in situations like that? Lord, I need to know now. What do you want me to do? What is the right thing to do? Do I do this or do I do that? And maybe he gathered his counselors. I don't know, his servants. And some of them maybe said, David, you're the king. You're going to have to buck up here. It doesn't matter that this is your son. You must deal with him. That is what God ordained you to do. You've got to deal with Absalom. Get an army together. Go take care of him now before this insurrection gets any worse. Would that have been the right choice? Now, some of you would say, yes, maybe to that. That's what David should have done. This is a failure of David's here. If he'd have been the man he should have been, if he'd have been in touch with God the way he should have been, he would have got up and done his administrative duty. Is there another side? Was this another power test for David? Did God just raise up another test? David, do you still trust me with this nation? Or do you think you're the man? Are you going to choose power this time? Or are you going to let this in my hands? So you can maybe build a case for that. And so David has to decide what is right and what direction do I go here? And in a moment's notice, sometimes people ask me, what is the toughest thing about leadership? What is the toughest thing you face as an administrator? And I know what I want to say, but I also know I'm foolish for saying it at the same time. What I want to tell them is this scenario that goes something like this. I have an issue. It's usually in the form of one of the other teachers banging on my door. Bang, bang, bang. I'm in the middle of history class, but they've got an issue. Bang, bang, bang. And I go to the door and there they stand. Help me. Tell me what to do. And so right now, her class is waiting. My class is waiting. We must figure this out. And the reason she's coming to me is because this thing is heavy and that my parents might not respond right. And so if I will just tell her what to do, she will go do it. And then if there are any ramifications, she can say, well, Linford told me. Okay? So we're sitting there, leaning on the library shelf. She's still doing this. And I look in the sky. There's no answers up there. I look on the library shelf. There's no answers there. Is there a Bible verse? There's no Bible verse comes to mind. Lord, give me wisdom. Nothing. So empty. I want to do the right thing here. I want to make everybody happy. I want to make the parents happy. I want to make the teacher happy. I want to make the school board happy. I want to make God happy. I want to make the little child that lied happy. So how can I do this? Well, there's this big scale between extreme justice and extreme mercy. Oh, I'd love to hit the middle of the road. But somehow, we make a decision. We finally say, we're going to do this. And maybe it was a little on the justice end of things. We're going to come down on this, make a statement, so this doesn't happen again. And then there's the ramifications. One parent comes and says, way to stand your ground. It's time people stand up around here and take care of this problem. It's been going on for too long. Way to stand up. But then another parent comes and says, you know, I think you should maybe be a little more compassionate. So now I have a dilemma. One parent says, way to stand up. The other one says, I think you should have been a little more compassionate. Which one was right? Now, if I can just figure out which one of those two was the most spiritual, then I will know which one God was for. So I figure out which one was the most spiritual. This one was the most spiritual. Okay, that was the right thing to do. You know what? That's the way our minds work. You know, I can never figure out which one was the most spiritual. If I try that, you know what I'll do? I'll end up, by default, siding with the one that is the most political. The one that has the status. And status and spirituality don't always go together. So the next time, teacher's on the door, bang, 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 help me. And so, okay, this time we're going to be merciful because I got in trouble in that last call. Let's be merciful this time. And then the parents start coming. The first parent says, way to be understanding. That was so nice. But then another parent says, you're allowing yourself to be pushed around. And again, who's the most spiritual? Then I'll know God's way. These are foolish reasonings because we are way too manipulated by what people are thinking. We're way too concerned about what people were thinking. Do you think David was concerned about what people were thinking? Maybe he did struggle with that. But when it came right down to it, what I really want you to see out of this verse is that there's nothing said in the Bible about David seeking God's direction here. The servant came and said, David, Absalom is coming. Now, it could have been that David dropped to his knees immediately. But there's nothing here said about David going to the temple and waiting on the Lord. What shall I do? No, there wasn't time. And so was fleeing the right thing to do? Maybe you take issue with that. Maybe you can make a case for that. What I want you to notice, though, is that David was true to his life principle. In the spur of the moment when a decision had to be made, he went back to a principle that he had lived his life by. And David's principle that he lived his life by were these. God is the sovereign of this nation, and I will not be corrupted by power. David had lived his life by that. There are at least three times in David's life when you see this. The first one was when he was the harpster in the king's court, and for whatever reason, there's a verse there that says, a couple of verses later it says, but David went back to the sheep. And for what, we don't know the reason, but for some reason, David had to go back to taking care of sheep. That was the first time David walked away from prestige and position. The second time we looked at yesterday. And now this is the third time in David's life when he was faced with a very difficult decision. What should I do? What do I do? And in the moment, he went back to a principle that he lived his life by. Well, this principle has always served me. God has honored me for living this way. And I'm not exactly sure what to do, but I'm going to do this. I've lived my life by this principle. This is what I do. I'm fleeing. I'm going to run away. This is God's nation. He can run this thing. It was easy for David to imagine Absalom being king because he had imagined Saul being. He had lived under the reality, actually, of Saul being king. And God took care of it when Saul was king. God could take care of the nation of Israel when Absalom was king. Just get me out of here. I will not be corrupted by power. And in those moments when I have to make a decision and I pray and I say, Lord, give me wisdom, but there's nothing written in the sky, and finally I go back to principles that have served me well. When the teacher's outside the door or I have an issue with students, there are certain principles that I have that come to my mind first thing. Such as, I don't know what your principles are, but a few of mine are, seek first to understand, then to be understood. You've heard of that principle already. That's just a principle when there's conflict that I try to, okay, just stop. Let's try to understand before I start spilling the stuff. If things are not clear, err on the side of mercy. All punishment should be redemptive. And so when things are tough, remember the principles that have served you well. And so whether you agree or disagree with what David did here as the right thing to do, you have to give it to him. He followed a principle. And David, I do admire David here because he was not an ambitious man. And I tend to favor the side here that God was giving him one more test to see if being king for X amount of years had corrupted David. And it hadn't. He still was able to walk out of here and let God handle it. And I have a poem that I carry in my Bible as a reminder to me. I don't like a lot of clutter in my Bible, but I need a Bible memory marker, right? And so my Bible memory marker has this poem on about ambition. It's one of my favorite poems. I had ambition, by which sin the angels fell and Absalom. I climbed and step by step, O Lord, ascended into hell. Returning now to peace and quiet and made more wise. Let my descent and fall, O Lord, be into paradise. I think David's in paradise. I don't think Absalom is, but we'll let God be the judge of those matters. And many of us are far too ambitious. Speaking of ambition, you know what one of the cures to ambition is? It is criticism. And so what do you do with criticism? Do you like criticism? Some of us really get rattled when we're criticized. And the more we put our lives on display, the more criticism comes our way. David faced criticism once. Actually, he faced it when he was fleeing from Absalom. Remember that man? I think his name was Shimei. He was related to Saul. He acted like Saul. And he threw stones at David. I don't know what kind of brazenness you have to go do it. The scene is intriguing. Here's David, barefoot, running away. And this man standing up on the hill throwing stones at him. And David said, now, Abishai was all bent out of shape about this. David, let me go kill him. David said, let him curse. Get some duck feathers going and just let the water roll off your back, right? Just let it go. Let him go. God may have told him to curse me. I won't say more about that. Need to move on, but I will give you this quote. My favorite quote out of J. Oswald Sanders' book on spiritual leadership. Often a crowd does not recognize a leader until he has gone. And then they build a monument to him with the stones they threw at him in life. I have two more passages that I would like to look at. I'll stick them both up here. The final words of David as an old man. 2 Samuel 23, verses 3 and 4. David is giving some of his wisdom now. He's lived a full life. He's been tested many times. And these are we call these the last words of David. He that ruleth over men must be just, ruling in the fear of God. And he shall be as the light of the morning when the sun riseth, even a morning without clouds, as the tender grass springing out of the earth by clear shining after rain. David knew how to use words. David could make some of the most beautiful word pictures. And here he defines the most beautiful leadership. It is, and this is interesting because David was a military man. He was carried the sword. You know, military men are known about force and power. These are the words of one of the greatest military men that ever lived. And they don't sound anything like a military man. And will you be known for your clear shining? Remember what we said yesterday. That's what they're going to remember. They will forget the bulletin boards. They'll forget the teaching style. They'll forget the stories. But they will remember the clear shining. After rain, after the troubles, when there were issues, and how you worked through them, and how that was dealt with. When I first walked into the classroom 12 years ago, I didn't know anything about relating to adolescent age children. I didn't know them. I didn't know many of their families very well either, and they didn't know me. And there was a natural amount of fear there. That ancient Renaissance fellow, Machiavelli, if that's how you say his name, he said it's safer to have your people fear you than to love you. Was he right about that? It's safer to have people fear you than to love you? Well, in that first year, there was this natural fear there. The boy said a bad word on the playground, and everyone all of a sudden got quiet. What is he going to do? And I didn't do anything because I didn't know what to do. I was shaking as much as they were. But I knew I had to do something. Once we got in, I told the boy to come up to my desk. And oh, I will never forget how he came to my desk. And the way he came to his desk made me nervous and rattled. And when he got there, I said, "You said a word that should never be said in a Christian school." And I just made it sound very grave and awful. And I wonder if that boy ever said that word again for the rest of his life. But as time goes on and you begin to develop relationships, and the students respond to you more openly because you've responded to them more openly. And now all of a sudden, it's hard to keep order and control, because you chose the way of relationship and love. And I've struggled with that. I've struggled to know how to balance this thing of fear and order and love and relationship. I want there to be clear, shiny, but I also want there to be order. Well, I want to tell you something. In your first year, there is that natural, if you're a first-year teacher here, there is that natural fear that is there. Use that time really wisely to establish some really good classroom management, so that when very open relationships have been established, things don't go to pieces and get chaotic. Because I am a believer that David had it right here. I love the clear shining and the light of the morning. And how will you respond when they ask silly questions? Will you belittle them? I enjoy when the students ask funny questions, but yet I hate the scene, because it's so hard to know how to not end up belittling the student or making the student feel embarrassing. I had a high school boy once. We were talking about submarines, and he raised his hand and he said, what's a submarine? And everyone just died laughing. That was in my first year too. And I said, "You don't know what a submarine is?" "No." "Well, you get out of your seat and go over there to the S Encyclopedia and look up submarine." It was terrible. I'm as embarrassed of that as I am the boar story. Years later, I went. He right now he's married and he's a missionary in Guatemala. And I went back to him years later and said, "Do you remember that?" "Yeah. That was awful." That is not how you respond when you get us. That is not clear shining. Some boys, the Air Force brought their Thunderbirds to one of the airports in the valley. F-16 Thunderbirds. Boy, that really gets the boys wound up. And there were a couple boys talking about how fast these F-16s are. And one of the boys walked in and said, "See, F-16s, they have like a 5-speed transmission, don't they?" And there again, how do you respond that boy will not feel like a fool? Now, you can laugh at a student or you can laugh with a student. I don't know who told me this once, but there's how do you do that? What's the difference there? And the difference is this: laughing at a student is when over here sits a student and you're looking over here at the other students and you're laughing. But laughing with a student is when they do something funny and you make eye contact with them and you laugh with them. That's just one little thing. We have to develop these faces, these interesting faces. All teachers need to know how to make faces. And you find yourself combining such contradictory emotions. You know, like in that situation, it's a hilarious comment, but you must be sympathetic. Now, how do you put a face on that is both hilarious and sympathetic at the same time? How do you do that? If you want to know the person that does that best, it's Gerald Miller. I don't know where. Yeah, back there he is. Get him to demonstrate his hilariously sympathetic face. He puts his whole body into it, actually. Stern love. Show me that face. This is why teachers are accused of being two-faced. I had to say it because Howard Bean was going to. Stern love, righteous indignation, loud silence. They will remember you for your clear shining after they've forgotten everything else. The final verse that I want to look at is from Psalm 71. Verses 17 and 18. O God, thou hast taught me from my youth, and hitherto have I declared thy wondrous works. Now also, when I am old and gray-headed, O God, forsake me not, until I have showed thy strength unto this generation, and thy power to everyone that is to come. That is his life verse. He's been that way all of his life, as a shepherd boy, as a fugitive, and as a king, and now he's an old man. And he still has this burning passion to show people his big God. David was not afraid to put God on display. And I hope as you go into your classrooms this year, you are not afraid to put your life on display, which is equivalent to putting Jesus Christ on display. I know it's a little place of service, and I know that you do not feel like that you do much. But there's an interesting illustration in the book of Ezekiel that has always blessed me when I feel like my place is small and when I feel like I'm not doing much. Ezekiel saw some water flowing out of the temple. It was just a little bit of water flowing out of the temple. And that's all he could see. But the angel said, "Come with me." And he began to follow the flow of the water. And the angel stopped and said, "Now walk through this stream here." And the water came. There was more water now all of a sudden. Where did all this water come from? Up at the temple it was just a little bit. But this is up to my ankles. Interesting observation. The angel said, "Let's keep going." He kept walking. And the angel stopped and said, "Now go through it." And now he's wading up to his waist. Where did all this water come from? And the angel says, "Interesting observation. Let's keep going." And they walk a little further. And now there are waters to swim in. And trees are growing along the side. And they're benefiting. And there's fruit. And there's fish. And where did all this life come from? Back at the temple. It was just a little trickle. And that's your influence. And may God bless you in your classroom this year, as you put Jesus Christ on display.
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit thedocforlearning.org.